out RGBA data, you have to change that. If your camera spits out BGR data, you have to change that as well. Once you've done that, the texture is now created. Now, when the app starts up, there'll be a grey polygon. That's it. The video hasn't been copied in yet. So when we get to the video part, change texture, this is where the fun part happens. Change texture takes in a char star pointer. And so what we do is now we're going to replace the texture with the live video frame. So we enable texturing mode, bind the texture that we created previously, and now we configure OpenGL to take the pixel data. And now we use a call called GLText Subimage 2D, which takes similar arguments as before, but what this function does is it replaces a portion of the existing texture with a new texture. Now, the texture is 512 by 256, but the video frame is only 320 by 240. Now, I'm really lazy. I don't want to have to pad the data out to make it fit. GLText Subimage 2D is capable of copying the data in intelligently and replacing only that portion of the texture. So I used this call up here to do the initial creation, but then I used this Subimage 2D just to replace the portion of the texture that has the video in it. And that takes the video frame, puts it in, and it does the necessary padding to make it fit into that piece of memory that we allocated before. So, yeah, everything's much nicer after that. So this is a nice call to use because it does all the work for you. I actually did some profiling, though, of my code under Mac OS X, and I found that that call was actually quite expensive. So I'm not sure if I can do it better, though, so I have to play with that some more. But anyway, so that loads the texture in. And so the thing with OpenGL is that what we've done here is we've copied the new texture in so that now whenever any other code draws with that texture ID, it'll get that video attached to it. So the OpenGL code that actually draws the boxes out and so forth, all it knows is that it's drawing with texture ID number 1. It doesn't realize it's a live video stream. So you kind of do this stuff in the background when no one's looking. So that's how the texture's done. We talked about how it's drawn before. So if we go back to the V4L file. So everything's in here. So that's the minimal amount of code you need to do a video for the next video session. So let's go back to the slides. Alright, so that's video for Linux. Next thing we're going to talk about is FireWire. I really like FireWire. FireWire is the best thing that's ever happened to video under Linux. It works really well. We've had probably FireWire for a couple more than two, actually. I think that's a bit old. We've had FireWire for a reasonable amount of time. It came out in 2.4 series kernels. So we've had it for about 3 or 4 years now. What I found with, that's probably correct as well, but what I found on the Mac when I was profiling it was that it was burning a lot of CPU, because it has to take every row of data and then pad it, and the padding process took some time and also to dump it on the cards. I'm not sure. It's hard to tell, but it's one of those things that, it's something to deal with. One of those things where, I mean, I have to change it, so you've got to do it, but yeah, I'm not too sure. So FireWire stuff. So FireWire is able to be used for a number of things, so most people probably used it for hard drives, possibly. FireWire is nice, though, because it's got 400 megabits of bandwidth. It actually came out like the same time USB 1 did, so it's been around for a while, but it's high bandwidth. So when they designed the standard, they put in standards for connecting hard drives and also for digital video cameras and digital cameras. We're going to talk about what the differences are, but they're all standardized as part of the FireWire specification, which is from IEEE. So we have what are called DV cameras. Now, a DV camera is a digital video camcorder that you hold in your hand and you film things and record it to a DV tape. This is not a DV camera here. So a DV camera is a standard camcorder with a tape in it. The way DV protocol is they use a special compression mechanism which is about 100 megabytes a minute, I think. It's really high quality. It's a slightly lossy compression, but not too lossy. So it's better than JPEG. 3.5 to 1. Okay. Yep, there you go, 3.5 to 1 compression. So. Yeah. So, I mean, they use a slight amount of compression, but dealing with that compression in the computer actually requires a bit of work. So you've got to do some kind of YUV conversions and a few other things like that. So dealing with raw DB data coming in requires a computer to actually think about it. Now we have other devices called DC cameras. This here is a DC camera. All the FireWire webcams you buy that do not have cassette tapes on them are all DC cameras. If you're buying anything to do with TV or broadcasting, then it will be DB. So these are DC cameras. They have their own standard, and they're not television related at all. The DV standard has a lot of things there to do with TV and... Yeah. That one there is about $200 Australian dollars. So they're quite cheap. I mean, the thing with the USB cameras is you can get them super cheap because they make them in bulk. Yeah, but yeah, crap, that's the problem. The thing is, though, is that because they sell so many of them, they can make them cheap. The problem with the FireWire cameras is that when USB brought cameras out, it killed off the market for FireWire cameras. If they had not brought USB 2 cameras out, then FireWire cameras would have become popular. And so that's bad for us because we're Linux people. But if you're a Windows person, you don't care. And so the Windows people have kind of trampled over DC FireWire cameras. There's just no huge market for them. And everything's about the market size. If there's enough people who buy it, it becomes cheap. So you can blame your Windows friends for that. The problem with the USB 2 cameras is they're just junk. The drivers are terrible. Even under Windows, they don't work. And your box becomes unstable, and then every time they bring a new release of Windows out, the drivers just stop working because they worked by accident the first time. And it's just, yeah, they're not scalable. So the FireWire stuff, you pay a few dollars more for it, but it just works, and they work. Sorry? The DC cameras? Oh, yeah. Apple EyeSight's a DC camera. That's called a Pyro Firefly. Some company called ADS Technology sells them. And there's a company called Point Grey that sell high-end cameras. We bought this one camera that cost $12,000, and it was 1280 by 1024 dual cameras, and you could do stereo vision with it. It's called a Bumblebee. So if you're doing scientific stuff, you can buy these hideously expensive cameras that are super-duper high resolution. Anyway, so DC cameras, so that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, the nice part about DC cameras is they support two modes. You can say to the camera, give me YUV frames, so it uses 16 bits per pixel, and you get 30 frames a second at 640 by 480. Or you can ask for RGB data, RGB, at 15 frames a second. There's actually not quite enough bandwidth on FireWire to do 30 frames a second RGB, so the standard doesn't let you do it. RGB stuff is sweet, though, because these RGB data comes off the bus, it gets dumped by DMA straight into memory, and then you do nothing with it. You just throw it at the video card, no conversion required. The YUV actually requires you to think about it a little bit, unless your video card does YUV directly. But we like RGB data. AR Toolkit takes RGB data in, so the nice part is you can get the camera to do the dirty work for you, so you can offload it from your CPU. So rather than wasting, you know, some percentage of your CPU doing conversions, you push it into the camera and say, look, burn some bandwidth, I don't care, I just want that picture and I don't want to have to deal with it. And so the camera does it for you, so that's kind of nice. So the standard demands that every DC camera has to implement this, and all DC cameras look the same. When you start going to high-end modes like high resolution, then the standard isn't quite applicable because the standard didn't define those sizes. But for most cameras that we use, the standard is really good. And the nice part about the standard is that all DC cameras use the same FireWire driver. So there's one DC driver in Linux that does all cameras, compared to USB cameras where there's two people using each kind of camera and they don't work anymore and stuff like that. So it's really easy to maintain the driver because lots of people all use the same driver. So we're only going to talk about DC today. There's a libDV to do DV cameras and a libDC to do DC cameras. So, the libDC library has no documentation whatsoever. I actually asked the guy who wrote AR Toolkit driver for it. I said, how did you work out how to do it? Because I read the header file and you get these people like, header file is self-documenting. Like, I don't like that. There's no such thing as a self-documenting header file. And it seems, have you ever looked at the kernel lately? You go in there, there's no comments in there anywhere. But the people who do it know what they're doing, but for people like me who don't really know how it works, it's quite hard. So the DC library's got no comments in it whatsoever. And if you've got problems with it, you're kind of stuck. But I asked the guy, I said, how did you write the driver for AR Toolkit for libDC? And he goes, my friend wrote the libDC driver. So that's how he found out. There's a bunch of different versions. Do not use Debian Stable because it has version 8 of libDC in it, and version 8 is busted. Version 9 was the first one that actually worked properly. It supported multiple cameras at the same time and so forth. They've had version 8, 9, 10, and 11. Version 11 is in Debian right now, in testing, and you should use that one. I've actually made patches to AR Toolkit in SourceForge to support all the different versions. The other thing I want to complain about is the libgc library, they kept changing the API for one of the function calls, but they did not put a version number at the top of the file that you could detect with an ifdef or anything like that. So it's impossible to write code that supports all four versions. However, version 11 in Debian is version 1.0, and so I'm hoping now that they're not going to change the API anymore, because they were just changing it all the time, and I'd have to keep tweaking AR Toolkit to make it work, and tweaking all my other code. I think it's stabilized now, so it should be good.
So yeah, make sure you use the latest version of it. Do not use anything less than version 11, or you will have grief.
Libdc is kind of evil to program to. I really don't know how to do it myself. So what you do is
you should use someone else's interface. So AR Toolkit, GPL code,
has a video interface you can use, which is cool because it's quite generic. AR Toolkit has got libraries for Mac OS X, Windows, Linux, video for Linux, Linux 1394, SGI. So if you write your code to talk to their video code, it'll work on any platform, which is kind of cool. Alternatively, OpenCV has FireWire support built into it as well. The latest release of that has FireWire and Video for Linux support, so you can use their interface driver as well. So better off using one of those to save yourself some time. As I said before, the DC spec defines interface for all cameras, so they all work. And I've bet the farm basically on DC cameras, and I've been using them for years, and they're really cool.
So they're a bit expensive, but it is well worth the money. I mean, if you think, you could buy a $30 camera and then spend 2 weeks messing with the code, and even if you're only making $10 an hour, that's like $1,000 you've spent on your time trying to fix some dodgy driver. So best thing is spend the money on the DC camera and just, yeah, make yourself easy. Make your life easy.
Okay, as I said before, IGV24 is a good mode because you basically take the data, throw it straight at OpenGL or whatever you want to do without too much hassles. USB cameras and DV stuff tends to rely on the software doing some kind of decompression. And so I don't like them because I want to do as little amount of work in my computer as possible. My goal one day is to get a really small, super tiny laptop that has almost no processing power because everything's kind of offloaded. That's what I'm trying to achieve. So I don't want to burn my time up. There's a nice program called Coriander, which you can use to talk to FireWire cameras. So I'll just fire it up. So Coriander does everything. It's so cool. All that stuff's running on batteries, so... Okay, so Coriander fires up. It brings up a list of all the cameras you've got connected up. And then you can say, okay, so you can see all the specs for the camera. You can then say, okay, services, receive, display. I have found in the past that sometimes Coriander doesn't work. And I've got no idea why. Just sometimes... Oh, there we go. Sometimes it just doesn't bring a window up, and I've got no idea why. Oh, there we go. Okay. This is another thing I hate about PC hardware is that, you know, you only get the display on one card because it's doing acceleration. It doesn't send it to both displays. All right. So anyway, so we've got that. So now you can go to the settings menu and you can adjust. Oh, here we go. So this is currently saying I'm getting 4 frames a second. That's because this computer doesn't have acceleration on it right now. You can pick the mode that you want. So you can control what kind of input format you want. You can also control things like brightness settings, so you can control that manually. So you can make it bright, dark, whatever. So the nice part about the DC spec is it defines a whole pile of features that all can be controlled through software. So everything, the really expensive cameras support all of them. Some of the cheap ones don't support everything. But yeah, so Coriander is quite good for that. So have a play with that. There's another tool called GScanBus, which brings up a list of all the FireWire devices. So if I disconnect my camera, it shows you a tree structure showing what's connected to your computer. And if you have weirdness issues, then you should check that to have a look. So that works pretty good. So, and you can also chain up multiple cameras. And if you've got a libdc greater than version 8, they'll all talk at the same time. The only thing you've got to do is watch out you don't burn all your bandwidth up. It's impossible to run two RGB24 streams simultaneously because there's not enough bandwidth for it. So you've got to be careful with that you don't... burn up too much. So someone today pointed out, they said they reckon they heard there was rumors that the 2.6 kernel had poor support for FireWire. I haven't been looking at that, but I use 2.6 right now, it works really good for FireWire. 2.4 worked, but what I found happened was is that occasionally it wouldn't detect the camera, and you had to reload all the FireWire modules, and that would work. As part of my little archive for tutorial, I have provided a file called 1394 reset, and 1394 reset program reloads all the FireWire modules on any version of Linux. It's got a few tricks in there that do a few things. So if you're having problems, run that script and see if it straightens it out for you. 2.6, I've never had to run that script ever. It just works. And the only time the FireWire fails is that laptop's got a dodgy FireWire connector and it's starting to break. And it's sort of half connected and it sends all these weird events to the kernel, which kind of freaks it out. But, you know, assuming the hardware's not broken, I haven't had a single drama with it yet. So 2.6 is pretty safe to use for this kind of stuff. It's important that you configure your devices correctly. I've written a script that I'm including in the archive as well, which sets up the devices for video 1394. For some reason, distros don't quite get this right. You can either use my script, or you can install my Debian packages that I've put up, and they will straighten it all out for you automatically. You should always use the latest 2.4 or 2.6 kernel. Some of the kernel versions before 2.4.17 had busted FireWire support, and they also, in 2.4.17, decided to renumber the major minor numbers for the FireWire devices. So my script auto-detects which kernel you're running and creates them appropriately. So please use the latest one because you just cause yourself trouble otherwise. Version 11, different versions of libgc affect which your entry is as well. The version 8 of libgc was designed to work with old 2.4 kernels and not new ones, so stick with the latest stuff and you won't have any dramas. And see the notes if you want more information about how to sort this out. It's one of those things that they don't really talk about much and you just have problems with it, and hopefully this will straighten it all out for everyone. Okay, so that's FireWire stuff. The other thing with the FireWire code actually has a user space library, libgc. You can't actually cap dev video 1394 and get data out of it. You have to use all these iOptions. The device is kind of there as just a hook to get to the device, but you don't read and write from it in the same way that you do with video for Linux. You have to use these DMA interfaces. But it is nice because it has these DMA transfer modes, so it's much more efficient. So the DC and DV stuff is going to be with us for a long time. The video for Linux stuff, I think, is going to die. Except for PCI capture boards. This stuff is really the way of the future for a lot of camera stuff. So, it's cool to use this. Alright, next step, vision tracking. So we've got about 45 minutes, I think we're on schedule. So, I've shown you how to capture video, I've shown you how to display textures. Now what we can do is we can use video cameras to capture what's going on in the physical world. We can use computers to look at the image and extract out features and whatever else we want to do. One thing I've noticed is that you see a lot of research, people go, your vision tracking is going to happen one day. And we use this algorithm and we extract lines out. But actually trying to find out how to do that is quite hard, and it's also quite CPU intensive. Vision processing just burns your CPU up just doing anything. Because, you know, if you've got 100,000 pixels, you've got to step through every pixel and do some operation to it. That takes time. And all of a sudden, writing really optimized code becomes important to get the best performance out. The thing I like about AR Toolkit is the first example of a vision program I've used that little people like us can use to do something really cool. So I showed how AR Toolkit worked before by panning around with the camera. So now we're going to talk quickly about how AR Toolkit works. So the way AR Toolkit works is you have a video frame that comes in and you've got some little markers in the scene. There. Now, what it does, brings the video frame in, and then it extracts out the edges. So it converts the whole image to black and white, and it thresholds it, and it decides if a pixel is black or white. It then looks for edges, like the black and white boundaries that occur there. Now, this whole image is full of these boundaries as well, but it does the whole image, and then once it's done with that, it then looks for square edges that define a pattern. So if the pattern is bent or folded, it can't detect it because the lines aren't straight. So the rule is there has to be four lines that are all straight, all next to each other in a continuous box, and then it goes to look inside it. It then goes into the pattern and it extracts out the center pattern part there. It then looks it up against a pattern database that it has in memory. So you preload all those patterns in. You actually detect them with a camera. It saves them, and then later on when it sees that pattern again, it says, oh, this is pattern number 4 or pattern number 5. You can program in about 15 to 20 patterns before it freaks out. The search algorithm is... the more patterns you add, the more times it has to scan through the list. So reducing the number of patterns is a good thing. So once it's extracted the pattern out, then what it does is it does a 6-DOF pose estimation. So it sort of looks at the image, and like in real world, when something's further away from you, you get perspective distortion, when things approach a vanishing point. It looks at things like the perspective, and it uses that to work out the rotation. It uses the size of the marker to work out how far away it is, and the position in the frame to work out where it is relative to the camera. Then once it's done that, it then generates the position and rotation information and gives it back to you. The process for that is quite complicated. And then when you're done, you profit, and you end up with a matrix. So we're going to quickly walk through the simple test program, which is the program I ran before. That's the program that I drew the little cube on. So you can download our toolkit from SourceForge. They got a bunch of little test programs here that do a bunch of different things. So, some of the code in our toolkit's kind of evil. Like, they do error checking in some functions and they return error codes, but then the other functions don't check the codes it returns. So, it detects the error, returns -1, and then dies later on. Like, they didn't do a very good job of that. I won't go through too much of this code. There's a lot of AR Toolkit specific stuff in here, but the action all happens here. So AR Toolkit has a function called AO Video Get Image. So you retrieve the image, you get yourself a 8-bit, basically an array of char stars from here, and then gets returned back. Then the action happens here. They initialize the 2D mode, they display the image, but then what they do is they call a function called AR Detect Marker. They drop in the pointer to the char star stream of video. You pass in a threshold value. The threshold is between 0 and 1. That's basically the brightness that you want to be the cutoff from black to white, because it needs to use that to decide if a pixel is black or white in the image. And if you set the threshold too high or too low, it won't work, because the marker will become, it'll fall outside the range. You then pass in an array, which is an array of structures with marker info and then a number. Now, what this does is this goes through the image, detects the patterns, and then it returns back in this struct here a list of all the hits that occurred. So it'll say, I found marker 4 at this location. I found marker 5 here, marker 6 here, and so forth. And then this value returns the total number of markers that we found, I think. Then you capture the next frame and go through the loop over and over again. Yeah? The original AR Toolkit implementation was that it was every frame was different, but now what they do is they have some code in there that basically says, oh well, they actually look for each marker at different places every time, but they use previous data to try to smooth things out, and if you're looking at a pattern and then you bring your hand in, it can survive that a bit better, whereas previous versions wouldn't do it. But the algorithm is designed to go through each frame by frame and sort of not worry if there's no results from before. It's sort of a lot of vision track techniques. What they'll do is once they detect a thing in a certain part of the image, they won't bother with the rest of it. But if you take the marker out really quickly, it takes more time for the algorithm to recover. If you've got the CPU time to burn, then just do the whole image. So that's the main loop. So that detects the markers, and then inside this structure is the matrix that you can then use. So, and there's a function called ARGetTransmat that extracts that out. Now, I'll flip back to the slides and we'll explain how some of that works. Okay, so a matrix, for those of you who might not know, is basically a 4x4 array of numbers. They're floating point numbers. Everything in OpenGL is all floating point. The hardware supports floating point numbers directly, which is good. Now, in a matrix, we have 16 values. And this is a matrix is a core thing in OpenGL. Every transform you do, when you scale something or move it or rotate it, is always expressed using a matrix. And every video card that they release nowadays has dedicated hardware that's designed to do matrix multiplication really, really quickly. They do it faster than you can do on a PC. Now, AR Toolkit returns a matrix back to express where the camera is relative to the marker, position, and orientation. And you can basically take that matrix and throw it straight to OpenGL, and OpenGL renders the little cube on top of the marker. So that's it. So you don't have to do anything. It's when you want to do something else with it that it becomes fun. It's important to realize that AR Toolkit uses row-column notation. And so when you're doing C code, you've got to make sure you get the ordering right. C So here's some example matrices, sort of talking about matrices that probably beyond the scope of the tutorial, but the Red Book talks about them quite a lot, and a lot of good graphics books talk about them as well. So you should, if you're interested in this, you know, read up on matrices. They are your friend. Scene graphs all use matrices. You really can't do 3D graphics without understanding matrices. It is the way to do it. We have what's called an identity matrix. This matrix does nothing. So if you've got a video card that's just doing 2D rendering, there will be an identity matrix in the video card that basically every pixel that comes through just gets rendered straight out. However, if you want to translate every pixel, you fill in these three values here, and every pixel that gets pushed through the matrix will be offset by an amount. If you want to scale the object, you put values there, there, and there, and that will scale the image in all dimensions. To extract out the translation data from a matrix, you use this C code here. So you simply grab out those values of the array, because the matrix is always represented as a 4x4 array, and you're done. The rotation matrix is a lot more complicated. In a rotation matrix, all top left 3x3 elements are all filled with values to express the rotation. I won't talk about that because it's quite complicated, but graphics books will talk about this for you. So our toolkit gives you a matrix, and so you can use that to feed to OpenGL. The next thing is, what can we do with it? So I used our toolkit as a hand tracker for my backpack system. So you place markers on each thumb, and then our toolkit returns back the coordinate of where those markers are relative to my head. I then feed that information into my scene graph, and then my software then draws these cursors over the top of these markers here. That's what happens there. So that's basically the way my system works. That little box example is even more simpler because they're just taking the matrix, putting it straight in the application, and that's it. So what kind of things can we do with our toolkit? Well, you could use it to build a hand tracker for use on your computer at home. So what you could do is, if this is your computer on your desk, you could put a video camera that looks at you, and then you could use hands with little markers stuck on the back of your hands to do something like that. So you could build a user interface based around using markers. You could use, you could put a video camera on a table, and you could look at your monitor and view three-dimensional data by panning around a little piece of paper so you can get views of different angles. So like that little box example, you know, if you want to see the other side of the 3D model, you just turn the piece of paper around, and you can throw that onto a monitor. The other thing you could do is you could put, say, a baseball cap on your head with a camera on it, and then you could put fiducial markers on your monitor, and you could build a tracking system that tracks where your head's looking, and you could use it to control the Quake game or something like that. You could generate real mouse events. So you could get a tracker that reads the position of your hands, and then given the X, Y values, you could generate fake mouse protocol that is then fed into X windows that could use to drive a cursor around the screen. You could use then, once you've got that, you could then use the control of normal KDE using some kind of hand-based interface. So, I mean, these are just examples. I haven't done any of these, but some ideas you might want to think about if you're interested in this kind of stuff. The other thing we did with it was we built a small tracker that we could use on our backpack. So we had three video cameras, and we have a bunch of markers on the ceiling of our lab. This photo is actually quite weird because the lab's too clean. We got these markers on the roof here, and the video cameras look for them. And as you walk around, we use AR Toolkit to track where we are. The thing with AR Toolkit is it is really not designed to do tracking. AR Toolkit, it's actually a bit of a hack, because when they draw the box on top of the marker, the box overlays correctly, but it's actually not accurate. The values it's putting out are not actually true measurements. And with my glove tracking system, you actually find the cursor doesn't always quite line up. And the mathematics are quite complicated, but basically they have a bunch of cheats in there that make it work really well for doing what it does, but it makes it not work very well for these kind of things, so be wary of that. If you want to know more, either email me, or I have a webpage with some papers that discuss this problem. This problem is quite hard, actually, because you've got all these cameras pumping data out, and you've got a limited amount of firewire bandwidth. We did this about 2 or 3 years ago when we were version libdc version 9, and the kernel used to panic sometimes when you put multiple cameras on, so we had to put a few tweaks in. This camera here is running at 15 frames a second. These two run in black and white at 7 frames a second because we need to conserve bandwidth on the bus, and they're also low resolution. So you can individually control the bandwidth of every camera so that there's enough bus bandwidth for everyone. It's possible to hook up about 4 cameras to a computer before it starts freaking out. A lot of the drivers and stuff haven't really been tested with more than one camera. So even under Windows, if you hook up multiple cameras up, it kind of freaks out sometimes, depending on how many hubs you've got and all this other kind of stuff. One other thing I want to talk about, I didn't have a slide for it, but there's the OpenCV library. So OpenCV has Debian packages available, and just do app cache search OpenCV, put it in. It has a pile of demo programs to do really neat things like feature recognition and image conversion. So there are little demo programs that it comes with that you can give it an image, and it'll do, like, it'll detect outlines. It'll do feature tracking. I think there's a face tracking demo that you can give it a face and it'll follow it in a scene. So there's a lot of interesting things you can do with OpenCV as well. I haven't used it personally. One of my students is using it for a project he's working on. And the nice part about OpenCV is it's got a lot of nicely optimized functions that Intel have written. The code's BSD, so you can do whatever you want with it. And if you write the code yourself, it's always going to be slower. The people at Intel who did the research for this project are pretty cluey, and so they've spent a lot of time optimizing the code and picking the right algorithms that do the best job. So, you know, it's best to stand on the shoulders of giants when you're doing this kind of stuff. So that worked pretty well. And the other part is OpenCV is also, they've got an optimized library that they've provided, which if you're on Intel processors, it'll use special Intel instructions to do things like matrix multipliers and this other kind of stuff. They call it the Intel Performance Library or something. And you can use that to get more performance out of your code. GCC's optimizer isn't all that crash hot when you're really trying to get the best performance out of your code. The Intel compiler is a lot faster, especially when you're trying to take advantage of the SIMID extensions, or SSE2, whatever they call it. So yeah, you might want to have a look at that if you're interested in performance. But the OpenGL, the OpenCV library is nice. If you're writing your own vision applications, don't write your own background subtraction, don't write your own contour extraction code. If it's in OpenCV, you should use that, because you'll save yourself piles of time, and it will work better as well. Finally, we've got about half an hour left. I'm going to talk about building custom hardware. And then, in the spare time we have available, if any, we'll play with the backpack for a bit. Although, we do have another session at 5:30, so we may have to demo this another day or after that session. We'll work it out as we go. The thing important to realize is that hacking is not just about software. Hacking is also about hardware and attacking your computer with power tools. So, we have drills, power saws, soldering irons, sticky tape, plastic and metal. These are fun things to play with. And you can break things and, yeah. And unfortunately, you blow things up as well. Like, one time I made this custom flywire cable. Spywire has power over it. This camera here requires 12 volts to be fed into it. And a 6-pin flywire connector has power on it. Now, most laptops come with 4-pin flywire connectors. So, 4-pin firewire connectors do not have power over them, so the Dell there has a 4-pin connector. So you've got to get power from somewhere else. So you have what's called a firewire hub, which works similar to a USB hub, but it has power being fed into it. And then the firewire camera connects to the hub connects to the computer. So when I ran G-Scanbus, you can see the hub was there in the device tree. Now, what I thought is, well, I said, well, I'm really smart. I want to get rid of the firewire hub. So what I'll do is, I'll build my own cable that has a 6-pin connector on one end and a 4-pin on the other, and I'll just splice 12 volts in. So we stuck the camera in, and it worked, and then I pulled it out, stuck it in again, and it didn't work. I'm like, oh, that's bizarre. And then FireWire never worked after that, and I'm like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. So it turns out I blew up the FireWire controller chip on the laptop. And so then I'm like, uh-oh, now what am I going to do? So the problem is I need it, and at the time, the FireWire code didn't support VCMCA cards very well, and that was my laptop, and we didn't have any money to buy a new one, so I'm like, uh-oh, we're in trouble now. So this photo here is of one of my students, and that's the motherboard from the Dell laptop. And basically, we transplanted the FireWire chip over to a new one. So, it's very interesting, right? The FireWire chip that we blew up, the problem is that when you plug a FireWire device in, Apple had problems with their PowerBooks for this many years ago. When you plug the device in, a voltage surge goes down the line, and the camera, when it's powering up, it sends a random spike down the data lines back to the computer, and because as the device is powering up, all the internal components are settling down, and there's a surge that goes down the data line. And the surge can be up to 30 volts. And the PowerBooks had problems because when you plug devices in and you didn't have properly smoothed power, it would blow the FireWire chip up. So Apple had tons of warranty problems with their early PowerBooks. Apple are actually the only company that make laptops with 6-pin FireWire connectors that provide real power. But anyway, so the Dell laptop, the designers, when they put the chip in, didn't put protection on the data lines because, well, it's never going to happen. So my dodgy cable did something. Like, it was kind of proper what I did, but the Dell people didn't put protection for it, so anyway, they tasted it. So there's this little chip here called a TSB41AB1, and the chip is literally the size of your little fingernail. It's got 64 pins on it. So you can see his little 5-cent coin. So we worked out that was the chip because we traced the motherboard back to the connector. And so for a period of 8 hours, we carefully, you have to do the whole thing under a microscope as well. So basically it's like using your elbows to sort of do surgery. That's how big the soldering iron tip is under a microscope. So then we used a pick, we melted every pin, lifted the pins up. You have to make sure you don't break the motherboard. Throw the chip out. And the chip is cool because if you buy that chip in Australia, you have to buy the minimum quantity of 500 at 5 bucks each. And so I'm like, I didn't want to do that. So we found a US supplier that sold us these chips. So then we bought 5 of them, and I kept 4 just for key rings or something like that. But so we soldered the little chip back on, and bang, and then it all worked again. And that's the photo we took with the camera after it started working again. So I was really stoked. So we saved $1,200 out of that, because that's what Dell was going to charge for a new motherboard. But it only cost us $5 plus the time for 8 engineers for a whole day. But it was interesting anyway. So we did it more for the academic exercise to see if we could actually fix some hardware. So we do a lot of hardware stuff. Yeah, it's kind of fun. Some what? It took... the problem is it's so tiny, and we were being really careful. Like, the guy who did it said if he did it again, he could have done it in about an hour or two. Every chip, you had to get the microscope and lower it right down and inspect the lead to make sure it was soldered correctly and all this kind of stuff. So it's kind of evil. So it's heaps harder than mod chipping an Xbox or anything like that. So it's pretty crazy. Anyway, so we've built a lot of hardware in our lab, and the backpack is something we've built ourselves. So what I'm going to do now is talk about interfacing hardware and Linux. That was just a little side story. So there's parallel ports, serial ports, and USB ports that you can use to talk to devices. The problem with PCs nowadays is they're becoming hideously complicated. Like, I think someone gave a talk, I think it was Ted was giving his talk today, and he was talking about how, you know, device drives are just getting more complicated, and hardware is getting harder as well. Like, you know, years ago we had little serial ports, Ethernet cards, and that was about it. Nowadays we've got, you know, 3D cards that do DMA transfers, and we've got AGP buses that are designed to run at hundreds of megahertz, and getting the timing right, everything is really hard. And it's difficult for little people like us to make our own PCI cards and things like that. PCI was designed to give really good performance, but it alienates a lot of hackers like us. So the old ISA cards and stuff are really easy to make. They've got big fat pins, and they're slow enough that you can make your own card that doesn't have to be too crazy. Whereas building PCI cards and so forth requires you to do a lot of surface mount, and it's just not really accessible unless you're a real guru. So PCI, USB and FireWire, the standards are a lot more complicated than, say, RS-232. Anyone can hook up RS-232. So FireWire cables, if you strip the shielding back, you know, for more than that distance, the cable will stop working. It's so susceptible to noise that they've got all this shielding that they've had to put in there to make the cables work properly. So, you know, if you run them too long, they stop working. So there's just a lot of issues. So the other problem is that PCs are removing lots of legacy ports. And so nowadays, like, my laptop doesn't have a serial port anymore. Most Macs don't come with anything else except USB and FireWire. All the old stuff's being phased out. And the old stuff is what we can deal with. So there are some nice interface chips that we're going to talk about that allow us to use USB and so forth. So the notes have a lot of detailed instructions here. I don't have time to go through too much of it. But the notes have code examples to talk to the parallel port, the serial port, and the little gun. So read those snippets of code. It's everything you need to do. It's all good. So a parallel port is a 25-pin D-shell connector. So use it to hook up old printers. The cool part about a printer port is there's 8 data lines you can directly address yourself. And each of them can put out about 5 volts-ish. Although, yeah, it's 5 volts. The problem is the current's quite low. So you can't hang a really big device off it like a relay without blowing something up. So you've got to have a transistor to boost it up. But if all you want to do is flicker some LEDs on and off, you can do that. Now, on Sunsight, years ago, they had a thing called LED CPU meter. And so I've actually put a copy of that in my little archive. It's a GPL program that does a Knight Rider-style swishing thing with 8 LEDs. And based on the uptime of your system, it varies the speed of the swishing. as your uptime goes up, so that's kind of cool. So you can drive that. They have a little daemon that they provide that you run on your system that reads your uptime every 10 seconds and it updates the speed of the Knight Rider swoosh. So you can put one of them on your machines. And the little board for it's easy. You just hook up the wires to LEDs and that's it. So there's nothing really much to do. The problem with printer ports is that the old ones are only single direction, so you can only output values. There are a couple control lines you can use to read things in, but they're not as easy to do as the 8 data lines. There's actually a byte in memory that you just write to those 8 bytes, that byte, and it just sets the values on the printer port. But doing the other reading is kind of a bit hard. The other, you have to use what's called an IO perm call to request permission from the kernel to talk directly to the device. If you don't do that, you can't do it. So you have to be root. Yeah. No. How does that talk to it, though? Some of them talk via the device. I'm not sure how they work. Okay. Yeah, well, the example I've got basically doesn't need any kernel modules at all. There are some, there's a dev LP and a dev PAR port and a few other devices. I don't really know how they work and they require modules. And I also found that on one of my machines, if you had the PAR port module loaded, your ALSA support stopped working. So, I find just by talking directly to the I.O. port, it just kind of works. And I've supplied source code for you all to use if you want. So you do an I.O. perm to say to the kernel, hey, I want to talk to this port. You have to be root to do it. And then you do out B calls, which are direct writing to registers on the serial port card. So you have to know the address, you know, 0x3F8 or 0x2F8 or whatever the address is. And you write to that byte, and then you can send bytes to the printer port. The problem is that the CPU has to bang out each byte individually, so you've got to get byte, 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 byte to write it out. Now, there's no buffering. If you want to read data in and you're not reading the port at the time the data arrives, you lose it. So you can get it so that an interrupt is triggered every time a byte comes in, but it runs really slow. So years ago, you can get these things called clip cables or map link cables. You can run IP over a parallel port. If you actually run your computer and do a clip transfer, the performance of the machine just stops because there's so many interrupts drowning the machine out that it just stops working. Yeah. I'm going to talk about USB to serial in a minute. The USB to parallel adapters will probably not work with this code here because they don't map themselves directly into I.O. register space, I don't believe. And so talking like this directly to the hardware only really works if you have a real serial port with a real 16550, a real parallel port, so the USB ones I don't think will probably work. So this is parallel ports, a bit more of a hack. I'm not too sure about that though. All right, so the problem with Linux really doesn't deal well with someone banging data out through a parallel port because the whole system kind of jams up and the scheduling algorithms go out and just. It's really not the way to do it. So if you want to talk to a parallel port, the best operating system to use is DOS. We have this little CNC milling machine. We drive it from DOS because it doesn't do anything else. The machine has full control of the CPU, and it can bang everything out very precisely. Under an operating system like Linux, it's not in real time, and so the operating system can't do accurate timing. And so if you're trying to step a motor very accurately, Linux really isn't ideal for that unless you've got the real-time extensions running or a kernel driver designed to do it. I don't really know too much about that, but it's something to consider. Serial RS-232 stuff is what I've done most of my playing around with because it's a lot more friendlier on the CPU. So it's the little 9-pin D-shell, but you can also get a 25-pin version as well. You can get baud rates up to 115-200, slower than parallel port, but you can do buffering and the operating system likes it a lot better. So all my devices that I have, the GPS, the sensor cube and all that, they all go through USB to serial converters. So everything we do is RS-232 based on the backpack. The UART chip on board has a buffer that can hold like 16 or 128 bytes so that the CPU doesn't have to service it so often. You get a slight bit of lag though because of the buffering taking place. The problem with RS-232 is that if you've only got two serial ports, you can only hook up two devices. So one of the coolest things was that when USB came out and they provided USB to serial converters, you can throw a hub in and have 10 of them hooked up and it just works. So you can get around the limitations of your laptop. The way to talk to an RS-232 port is there's a POSIX serial port interface that Linux has. The thing with serial ports is they've been around for like 20 years or so, and so the API is really crusty and it's got lots of stuff in there that you don't really know what it does. And also, different like Linux to IRIX to BSD to whatever, They all implement everything slightly differently, and so being portable, you've got to be careful. I've supplied some example code in the notes, and you should read that. If you go on the net, they'll have some examples, but they don't quite have everything set up. And so the example I've got does things like setting non-blocking or blocking mode, toggling the DTR lines and things like that. So, and I've also tested that code under Cygwin under Windows. I've tested it under Mac OS X, and it just works on all platforms, so it's quite portable, and I've tested it out. If you don't get it quite right, the problem with a serial port is that the kernel initializes it to different default values on different operating systems, and if you don't initialize it perfectly right, the defaults might be right on one platform but not another, and so sometimes it'll just stop working when you move to a new machine, and that's why. So have a look at that code if you want to know how that's done. I won't go through it, but yeah. So the problem with a serial port is you need extra hardware at the other end. You've got these bits coming down, which are 8 bits in RS-232 format of little packets that are coming down. You really need something at the other end that can talk to it. So you can't really flash lights directly because the light doesn't know how to decode bytes and so forth. So you need some kind of microcontroller at the other end. So you can get little microcontrollers like a basic Snap 2. You can buy them from like Dick Smith for like $100. They're quite expensive, but they're hideously easy to program. The glove controller for the gloves in my system, I basically bought a basic Snap 2, knocked up a prototype board, and I had a glove controller working that would read the fingers from my hands, sending serial packets back to my computer in less than a day. So that was really quick prototyping. So you can get microcontrollers like PICs and MSP430s that you can program in assembly language, or in the case of MSP, there's actually a GCC for it. The problem with them is they just require a lot more work, and if you're just a hobbyist who doesn't really want to learn about microcontrollers, the basic Snap 2s are very nice. You pay a bit of money for them, but you save time. The MSPs and the PIC chips, you can buy them for a couple bucks each, but they do require you to do a bit more work. And you'll have to look around the net to find examples and stuff like that. The basic stamps are programmed using this variation of BASIC, which is really easy. It's hideously slow, but it does about 1,000 instructions per second on the basic stamp, but it's enough that it can pull these gloves 30 times a second. And it runs for like a week on a 9-volt battery, so the power drain is negligible. So they're really efficient. So the basic stamp basically reads in serial commands from the computer, and then it has 16 I.O. pins that you can use to toggle lights on and off. So previously when I talked about parallel ports, you know, you can use your super duper fast Pentium 4 computer to flip these 8 pins up and down, for example, for this lead CPU meter, but you burn half of the CPU writing these instructions out to the parallel port, and then you get stalls on the CPU and all this other kind of stuff. It brings your Pentium 4 to a crawl. You might as well use a 486 for it, because you're just wasting the CPU otherwise. The nice part about a basic stamp is you have dedicated hardware that reads commands, and then that hardware toggles the lines up and down. So you can offload the CPU onto a microcontroller, which saves your CPU, and you can also do much more accurate timing. The basic stamp is a dedicated processor that's just doing a task, and that's all it's doing. It's flashing the light on and off, and the timing is really spot on. If you get a Linux box to try to pulse a timer up and down, it's going to be all over the place because Linux is not really designed for hard scheduling. So microcontrollers can really help you out here. The only problem with the basic stamp too is the compiler they provide is a Windows thing. And so you have to keep a Windows box on the side to write the code for it. But this backpack here is fully Linux-based. Once you've programmed the microcontroller, it remembers the program forever in flash memory. So you don't need to keep reprogramming it. So once you've set it, you're done and you're all good. So the problem with serial ports is only a small number, so you can use USB to serial converters to do the trick. There are also PCMCIA ones you can get as well. The problem with them is they've got these little 50-pin SCSI connectors coming out the side, and on a backpack like this, these things get destroyed. So don't do it. The safest ones are the USB ones. I've been playing with FTDI FT8U232AM chips. They're really cool. You can buy them for about 11 bucks each. And when I was in Hong Kong, I actually managed to buy made converters that were fully shrink-wrapped and everything that work quite well as well. There's a website called beyondlogic.org, which is referenced in my notes, and they have tons of cool documentation about interface and hardware to your PC. We've got a lot of Windows stuff there, but a lot of the stuff they have is very generic for all operating systems. They talk about interfacing to parallel ports and serial ports, and they talk about these kind of chips, and FTDI company actually provided a driver for it, which is part of the standard kernel. The 2.4 kernel is busted for FTDI chips though, so it will kind of work, but it'll panic if you really hammer it hard. There were weird interrupt issues. 2.6 though works fine. Keith's Van Converters also work very well. I've been using them since about 2000 or 2001. And Hugh Blemmings, he gave a talk at LCA many years ago. He wrote the driver for it. Keith's Van stuff is excellent. So Keith's Van and FTDIs are really good. There's a couple other drivers in the kernel for these chipsets called Cypexes and a few others. I would avoid them. They're less reliable. Get these if you can, because I know I've tested them and they do work quite well. So yeah, they're quite good. Okay, so given all that, we can use this kind of hardware to make little controller boxes. So one of the things you want to do is, like in the case of this gun here, I want to control a computer with an interface that's really intuitive. I don't want to use a mouse or a keyboard, I want to use a custom device. So what we do is we can make up boxes that sort of do the I.O. for us. So you have a microcontroller, you have some switches hooked up to it, and the microcontroller reads those switches, and when it detects that they've moved, it then sends a command to the computer as a serial packet. So the way the glove works is that whenever I press a finger, it sends a small 1-byte packet to the PC saying left finger 1 was pressed and then released or something like that. And so you can very easily do processing for things like switches and buttons. You can then use it to control lights. You can also use it to control LCD panels. I've done some work playing around where you hook up those 16 by 2 character LCD panels and you hook up to your parallel port or a basic stamp.
Yep.
No, I haven't played with I2C. Yep. Yeah, the problem is you've got to get hardware for it. I don't have any of that. Sorry? Huh? Oh, okay. Where's the connector for it, though? Oh, okay. Cool, yeah. Gonna get to that. That's the little yellow gun. So microcontrollers are really good because they offload the CPU processing. So you really don't want to have anything in your code that's banging away at a port. That's really evil. Linux boxes and friends, the way the kernel's designed is designed to be event-based, that only when something interesting happens do you bother dealing with it. And so having to poll a port and do this is really kind of expensive on the CPU, so you really don't want to do that. So microcontrollers are your friend here, and you really should do something like that if you can. So what we did with the yellow gun was, I basically went to a toy shop and I bought a bubble-blowing gun that when you squeeze it, it used to blow bubbles out the front. And then you rip it open, and then you rip all the guts of it out, and then I had this old USB mouse that the wheel in it was busted. So what we did is we ripped out all the wheels and sensors and everything else, and all we were left with was basically the cable, the little motherboard that it comes with, and the little four buttons on it. So I desoldered the buttons, and then I put my own switches onto the gun, and then I ran wires from the switches to the little the mouse main board inside it. The thing with USB mice is people are either throwing them away, or you can buy them for like $10, the really, really cheapy ones. They don't need to be good quality because all you're doing is pressing the buttons. You're not using the optical eye part or anything like that. So then I buried the whole thing in the gun. It has a USB connector on the end. You know, total amount of work done, like, you know, 30 minutes. So there's no need to program a microcontroller. No need to do anything. The person over there suggested that you use, like, a joypad. So joypads have tons of buttons on them. So you can rip them open, put the electronics in something, and bingo, you're done. The thing about joypads, I haven't done much joystick programming, but they've got their own dev joy device that you talk to, and I'm not too familiar with them. The thing I like about these things is that it's standard mouse protocol coming off the mouse. So you can plug this into the Quake game, and then you go to the options menu and say configure the fire button, and then you press this button, and it goes mouse button one pressed. So as long as the mouse cursor is in the window of the game, this can control my Quake game without me having to modify Quake at all. So any software that reads mouse events, automatically read this gun. Whereas in the case of the joypad, it's a joypad which is a different kind of device. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, you could modify something like that as well. So you could, like the gentleman said, he goes, you can buy joysticks that generate keystrokes and so forth. So the moral of the story is that you've got to go to toy shops and hardware stores and sort of look around. Like, we in Adelaide, for those of you who don't live in Australia, we have a hardware store called Bunnings, these big warehouses. And you go up and down every aisle and you just look at stuff. And you go, wow, that would be really cool. I could modify it to do X. Like one time I went to buy some braided hose because I wanted to pound it flat to make metallic sensor pads. And I went to this plumbing shop and I go to the guy, I said, oh, do you have any quarter inch braided hose? He goes, that fixing your bathroom, are you? And I go, yeah. I had to explain to him what I was doing, I mean, this guy works in a plumbing shop, you know, so, oh, I'm doing augmented reality, and I've got a backpack, and I go outside. I mean, that's just too much. So it's just like, yeah, I'm fixing my bathroom. And the trick is when you go to the hardware store, don't rock up saying, hey, I'm working on this project on SourceForge, and I want to do this. The person at the hardware shop doesn't know about that. You've got to simplify the problem. You've got to try to rewrite the problem into something. I've got a problem in my garden and I'm trying to do X, Y, and Z, and then try to find a device that matches that. Like, So you always tell me running Windows. Yeah, exactly. Like, you've got to lie to them so they can help you. So if you make the problem too complicated, then it becomes too hard to deal with. So the moral of the story here, though, is that, you know, why work when you don't have to? You know, I don't want to spend months and months writing this crazy microcontroller when I can just chop up a $2 mouse that I was going to throw in the bin anyway. So, you know, that's something that you can do. Yeah, comment. Yeah, the problem with a keyboard, okay, like many years ago, I had this dream of I wanted to put an MP3 player in my car. So what it did is I got a keyboard, and then I hacksawed off the numeric keypad. And as it turns out, that the wire that came off was on the numeric keypad, so I thought, that's all right. So then I ran a file over the motherboard to clean up all the ragged connections from the hacksaw so that none of the tracks were shorted out. And then I plugged it into my computer, which had an AT keyboard in place at the time. And it just blew the controller up because they did something wrong. So, yeah, well, this was back in the day. This is pre-USB. You could do that. The thing in the backpack stuff is infrared doesn't work too crash hot outside. There are lots of things you can do. Actually, there are these really sweet Bluetooth dongles that I purchased. They're called Promi SDs. And basically, it's a little box that's the size of your thumb. It's got a DB9 on one end and an antenna on the other. You feed 5 volts into it, and you get 2 of them, you pair them. And you can run RS-232 over these dongles. And they go up to 38400 board. And I took it up 3 flights of stairs, and it worked from one through layers of concrete flooring and everything. And I had a sensor cube, one of these little trackers running, and I walked all up to my boss's office, and I had my laptop there, and it was spewing data out, and it was perfect with no packet loss. So the Bluetooth stuff has come of age, and you buy 2 of these dongles, they're about $100 at each end, and you can send data over it wirelessly over Bluetooth with no software required. Linux has Bluetooth support built in, so you can actually throw one of the dongles away, and the Linux Bluetooth code will talk directly to those other dongles. So there is a standard for doing serial port Bluetooth stuff. So one of the things you want to do is like get the gloves and have a microcontroller on each hand, no wires, and then 9-volt battery so it runs for a week, and then use Bluetooth to transport the data to the backpack so you can cut down the amount of wires. Sorry? Oh. I haven't used the Bluetooth stuff. I mean, for now, the problem is just getting the stuff working. Like, I mean, I don't tend to worry about security issues because I'm just happy when the backpack runs. I mean, the problem is you go outside, something breaks, and the battery goes flat, all those other kind of problems. And yeah, for now the challenge is just get the Bluetooth stuff working, get the wireless gear working, and worry about security issues later. Most of the machines in the lab, we run them behind a firewall because I tend to turn all the passwords and security off because it makes things really easy. Like, for a backpack, you don't want to have to type a password to log in. So I've got auto-login on lit up and stuff like that. So security tends to hinder usability when you're outside and you've got no keyboard, no mouse. You can't really edit settings and stuff like that. But anyway, so the thing here is that hacking gear can save you a lot of time. You know, you don't have to build everything from scratch. And in the same way that, you know, you shouldn't reinvent the wheel with software, you also shouldn't reinvent the wheel with hardware either. So, it's 5:26, so we're towards the end of the talk. So, in conclusion, we've gone through a pile of material today. Unfortunately, every one of the topics I could talk about in 3 hours. So, you know, it's a bit of a problem. I've got 45 pages of notes which I've written, which I want people to read. So if you're interested in this, please read them. If they just sit on the web rotting away, then they're not very useful. The notes have a lot of detail about everything I've talked about, and they're available from www.timmins.net/LCA2005. I think I've tweaked the slide once today, so I have to upload a new version, but pretty much everything there is what we've done today. We've talked about a bunch of things. We've talked about video capturing, displaying that video with OpenGL. We've gone through the 3D vision tracking library in our toolkit. I would encourage you to look at OpenCV as well. We've talked about building custom hardware that you can use as an input device to control your computer. And so, like one of the things I'm working on in my office right now is I'm building a door monitor, so it monitors when my door opens and closes.